Hi, this is The Takeaway. Today is Thursday, January 11th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. And here's some sound from the House floor on Capitol Hill Wednesday, a familiar protest from the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico.
Without the equal rights and responsibilities that are only available through statehood, Puerto Rico will never truly recover and prosper from the hurricane effects. That's the reason we demand and deserve statehood for Puerto Rico now.
That's Jennifer Gonzalez-Colon, Puerto Rico's resident commissioner to Congress, also known as a delegate or a non-voting member. And her demand there isn't a new one. Statehood for Puerto Rico has been a rallying cry for decades. But those who want it have a new urgency now, because Puerto Rico is still desperately struggling to recover from Hurricane Maria, made landfall 114 days ago. The federal government and the president himself quickly claimed success in Puerto Rico. They congratulated themselves for how well they executed the recovery. Meanwhile, about 40% of residents are still without power. Some may not have it until May. Hospitals are struggling with a shortage of supplies. And on Monday, the island's police chief resigned amid a spike in violence, while thousands of police officers are calling in sick to protest the lack of overtime pay. Donica Coto is in Puerto Rico for the Associated Press. She's in San Juan.
I think if you ask most people, they would say here on the island that they haven't seen that much change in the last 4 months since Hurricane Maria. There's still 40% of people without power, customers that is. In addition, there's about 6 to 7% of clients without water. And one of the biggest complaints is how slow recovery efforts are going. Just yesterday, the governor, Ricardo Rosello, was in Washington, D.C., and he told President Trump that no U.S. state would withstand more than 100 days, you know, without power. It would not be acceptable to have 500,000 homes destroyed or damaged and only have 30,000 blue roofs set up. So there's a lot of anger brewing. There's a lot of frustration. A lot of people still have been without power since Hurricane Irma, which was September 9th. And then, you know, Hurricane Maria hit September 20th. So those who are able to do so have left, but those who remain behind, they're basically fed up at this point.
40% of customers without power is still an astounding number, Donica. We've talked a little bit on this show about some of the makeshift workarounds that Puerto Ricans are using now because they haven't had power for so long. What are you seeing?
Well, we're still seeing, you know, neighbors who have generators or who have power finally, they're throwing extensions to those still in the dark. You know, a lot of people are spending extra hours in the office charging phones, eating warm meals. I spoke to one woman who would pick up her son from school. And again, you know, there's still hundreds of schools without power. So there's limited days that they go, limited hours. And then from there, parents usually pick them up, go back to the office. They have dinner at the office so they can provide their families with warm food. And then they head over to a darkened home. There have been dozens of communities across the island that are protesting this lack of power. But, you know, there's not much they can do. And the helplessness has turned into great frustration.
There's also been this huge exodus of people off the island, Donica. You mentioned it. Those that can have already left. Is it starting to feel like the tens of thousands of people who've left Puerto Rico are ever coming back or gone to the mainland permanently?
Well, if you ask economists, a lot of them would say, why would people return? If they found a job, they found a house or an apartment, you know, they've stabilized themselves and their families. You know, many question, why would they return to an island that is at this point not really promising much? You know, there's $73 billion in public debt that they're trying to restructure a portion of it. There's still, you know, again, 40% of people without power. And the financial outlook is pretty dire. It was dire before the hurricane, and many believe that the poverty rate will only increase. There was about 44% poverty rate before the hurricane, and economists expect that to increase to 52 to 60%, which is huge. And those are levels that have not been seen since the 1960s. So if someone is in the U.S. mainland with a job, a steady income, you know, a house, power, water, I don't think many people would risk coming back to an island that still is not providing that stability they need.
Well, this kind of economic crisis and the poverty that goes along with it does contribute to crime. And Donica, there seems to be a crisis within police departments in Puerto Rico now, sick outs, labor disputes, and a police chief that's resigned in the last couple of days. What's going on?
Definitely. The number of killings has skyrocketed this year. There's been 30 reported killings in just the first 9 days of the year, which is more than double than the same period last year. you know, the majority of men having young men, nearly all shot to death. And this comes as a result, in part, from an increase in police absences. In early November, more than 2,000 police officers a day, roughly, started calling in sick. And that's compared with an average of about 550 to 600 on a normal day. So these absences over the holiday period especially forced more than a dozen police stations to close anywhere from several hours to a couple of days because there were not enough officers present. You know, they are demanding millions of dollars that the government owes them in overtime pay, in part for work done, you know, after Hurricane Irma and Maria, with many working 12 hours a day without any days off. And in addition, they're also protesting a drop in pension in an economic crisis and the inability to cash in on new sick days like they once used to do. In addition, lack of power has also affected security. You know, 40% without power. There's a lot of dark areas, not so many police on the streets. So the Department of Public Safety, which was just created a couple of months ago, the head of that is a former FBI official who has been meeting with police, federal officials, and trying to figure out, you know, how to tweak any crime-fighting plans to be able to address the spike in killings.
Well, Donica, a lot of what you're describing, and I don't want to be melodramatic about it, sounds like some breakdowns in Puerto Rican society, an increase in poverty, 40% of people without power, tens of thousands who've left home altogether, possibly never to return, and a police department that's not policing while murders are on the rise. This all seems, when it's combined, like a really bad picture in Puerto Rico.
It is. I mean, I think before the hurricane, you know, this breakdown was very slow going. I mean, you would see it, but it was very slow going. And after the hurricane, I mean, that just accelerated it. You know, there were more than 30,000 jobs lost, more than 500,000 homes damaged. You know, it's impossible to operate businesses without power. People were leaving. Schools were not opening. So the hurricane accelerated all the problems that were going on. It deepened those problems. It worsened them. And now the island is still waiting for the roughly $5 million that Congress had approved. You know, obviously, there's still concerns about the management of money on the island. So the island has not received that money yet. And Ricardo Rosselló is still asking for a lot more. You know, the hurricane cost an estimated $95 billion in damage. And so far, the U.S. territory has not received any federal assistance, any financial assistance from Congress.
Donica Cotto with Associated Press in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Donica, thanks once again.
Thank you very much.
When Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico and knocked out services and power, it also dealt a devastating blow to a critical piece of medical care in America. The Baxter Company is the number one supplier of IV bags stockpiled by hospitals all over the country, and their manufacturing facilities are in Puerto Rico. Slow recovery from Hurricane Maria has now forced hospitals to cope with shortages. Deborah Pasco is Director of Medication Safety and Quality at the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. Hi, Deborah.
Hello.
First of all, people are familiar with IV drips, but tell us a little bit about what kinds of medical supplies we're really talking about here.
The primary concern are small bags of what we call small volume parenterals. And these are volumes of 50 to 100 mLs. People can think of that kind of like of three cups of fluid. That is the mainstay of how we dilute medications before we administer many IV medications and give to patients. So it's really critical that we have the supply, and then the absence of that, we really have to think of alternatives.
Okay, so that's the fluid-filled IV bag that's next to the bed, elevated in gravity, pulls the fluid down into your arm, essentially, bedside in the hospital, right?
Correct. And sometimes it's also infused by an infusion pump, where the nurse would set up the tubing and the pump would infuse instead of using gravity.
Well, how important are these IV bags to hospitals? What kinds of treatments, what kinds of medications are we talking about? Are they a staple?
They are a staple. We use hundreds to thousands of these bags, depending on the hospital size, every single day to dilute medications further before we give them to patients. This is especially important in the cancer area, where many of these patients, the drugs that we would give them for their cancer reasons, we would further dilute in these small bags. So that is a population that really is at risk during the shortage.
So Baxter's the number one manufacturer of these IV bags that are so critical. Their facilities are in Puerto Rico. So how bad is the shortage now across the country, and how are hospitals trying to cope, Deborah?
So I would say that we were actually in a crisis. And what I mean by that and how I define that, we recently did a survey in late November with our membership. We have about over 45,000 members, but we had about, in a week's time, 323 people that responded to them. And 99% of them said we have been affected to some extent, with two-thirds of them saying we have been affected to a severe extent, meaning that it's impacted their daily operations and they're having to be very fluid and flexible, literally from hour to hour throughout the day and making changes.
What does a nurse at the bedside in the critical care unit or elsewhere in the hospital do if they don't have the normal supply of the IV bags we're talking about? How do they work around?
The workarounds are a couple different things. One of them is a technique called IV push. So this is where we dilute a medication and dispense it with a syringe. And the nurse stands at the bedside and slowly gives that medication. It does require the nurse to physically push the syringe and push the medication in over a short period of time.
And that's more work and more time from the nurse because they have to stand at the bedside rather than letting gravity do the work.
Yes, it does take more of their precious nursing time to use these different techniques. There are other ways of giving medications, not as common as what really a lot of the hospitals are using this technique called IV push to a really large extent. Our members had indicated to us that almost 90% of them had started to use this method that has now become the workhorse in the absence of bags.
Deborah, we're going to talk about the flu season in just a minute, particularly bad in the Northern Hemisphere now as flu season develops. This shortage of IV bags in hospitals, do you see it having consequences for this flu season?
Absolutely. The reason I'm saying that is because we were already in an episodic shortage of the larger volumes of bags, like the liter bags, ever since 2014. We've never had what I would consider a consistent and abundant supply of those larger bags. And it is those larger bags that we use to rehydrate patients, especially influenza patients. So the other flip of the coin has been that in lieu of not having the smaller bags, some of them have started to use the larger bags and try to repackage them into smaller bag sizes. But when you do that, then you're using your larger bags too, which are critical for those patient needs. Influenza patients in particular, there are two things that they need. One of them is antivirals with drugs such as Tamiflu, and the other is hydration fluids. If you don't have one of those, it could significantly impact a patient and their outcomes.
And hundreds of thousands of American patients will land in the hospital with the flu this year. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. In the meantime, we reached out to Baxter. You can read their response saying they're increasing supply efforts and expect to have more bags on the market in the coming weeks. That's on our website at thetakeaway.org. Deborah Pasco with the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. We just heard about the shortage of IV equipment thanks to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and that has real consequences for hundreds of thousands of Americans who will be hospitalized with the flu this year. Have you gotten your flu shot? Public health professionals and your doctor actually want to know. Flu is not just the infection that keeps you home from work for a few days in bed. Flu kills more than 36,000 Americans every year and sends more than 200,000 people to the hospital. It is no joke. Well, this flu season is shaping up to be especially nasty, in part because this year's flu vaccine just isn't as effective as usual. We want to talk about why the flu virus is a little bit more dangerous this year and exactly what's going on with the flu vaccine. Dr. Tom Frieden is president and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives. That's an initiative of Vital Strategies. He was also director of the Centers for Disease Control from 2009 until 2017. Tom Frieden, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've heard a lot about a nasty flu season already. Why is it nastier this year? People are talking about an Australian strain. Is it stronger? Is it more virulent? What's going on?
There are different strains of flu each year. A predominant strain usually emerges. You can predict that by seeing what happens in the Southern Hemisphere months earlier. And this isn't from Australia, but it's circulating and caused a really bad flu season in Australia. It's a type of influenza A called H3N2 that tends to be quite hard on the elderly and on children. And that's why we're particularly concerned, because many of the deaths from flu season each year are in the elderly and tragically also in children.
And we've seen more infections and worse infections in Australia. Australia has its summer while we have our winter, so you can sort of see what's going on with the flu strains.
It gives us a pretty good guess of what might happen here, but the one thing you can predict about flu is that it's unpredictable. So only this year's flu season will show us what happens, but we know that we're primed for having a pretty bad year because of the strain of flu that's circulating, and because, as you mentioned, the flu vaccine may not be as effective this year as we would hope it would be.
Is the flu vaccine less effective against that H3N2? Is that the problem?
Each year, the flu virus changes a bit, and sometimes those changes make it so that the vaccine doesn't work as well. This vaccine, we think, will be about 30%, about one-third effective against flu. That's not nearly as good as a usual year where it's about 60, 65% effective. And of course, the flu vaccine isn't as effective as most of our vaccines, which are 80, 90, 95% effective. But the flu vaccine is still by far the single most effective way you can prevent the flu.
All right. Well, I want to talk about vaccines and how they're made. Before we do that, Tom Freedom, you are president and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives, an initiative of Vital Strategies. Does your company, your organization, get money from vaccine manufacturers or pharmaceutical manufacturers?
No. Resolve to Save Lives is fully funded by three very generous philanthropy groups, the Bloomberg Family Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative.
So no direct links to the vaccine industry. All right, so let's talk about how vaccines are made then. You talk about this lead time, and for years, public health people have said, we want to be able to make vaccines faster. They actually grow this stuff on eggs, hundreds of millions of eggs in factories all over America and in other places. People have been looking for a faster way to do this. One way is called cell culture. Find a new way to grow vaccines. They've been talking about this for many, many years, decades, in fact. Has this technology advanced? Is anybody using it?
Absolutely. There's a vaccine on the market today that's made entirely in cell-based vaccine production facilities. So it's there. It's an advance. It obviously doesn't leave us dependent on eggs. There's some evidence that it might be better, but we don't know that for sure. It's one of the enhancements we've had. There are other enhancements like shortening the time to produce a flu vaccine, shortening the time to confirm that it's as effective as we'd like or as potent as we'd like. And that's the kind of small tweak that can make a real difference. We're talking about a 4, 5, 6 month production period. If we can knock off a week or two here and there, we can get that down to shorter periods, then we can basically decide closer to real time which exact strains to use. We've also been using new technologies to get the best possible vaccine strain to grow quickly and in a way that's most likely to protect people against the flu.
You were at the CDC for 8 years during the Obama administration. People in your position beat down the doors and lobby every year, not only for the money that they need, but from the attention from policymakers to take things like flu, things like Ebola, frankly, seriously, even if they're not leading the cable news with threats of pandemic. What's the state of public health right now?
The risk is always that people will be more interested in fighting the crisis at hand, that often those in Washington think of what's going to happen next week, not 2 or 5 years from now. And public health doesn't always do well in that context, because when we're most successful, people don't see the problem because we prevent the outbreak. I often ask people if they remember the big outbreak we had in the U.S. of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. Most people don't, because we didn't have an outbreak. There were a couple of isolated cases. The hospitals did a great job. We had testing laboratories throughout the country, and it was stopped. So when you don't see a problem, it's hard to get Congress to invest in it. I'm encouraged by the fact that both sides of the aisle, within the administration and outside, there are many individuals who understand the importance of public health and care deeply about protecting Americans and understand that public health is essential to the health security of this country. Whether that translates into enough money for the CDC to protect Americans remains to be seen.
I want to ask you about one other issue from the CDC that people have heard about within the last couple of weeks, and it's a strange one. The idea that the administration has either banned or discouraged the use of certain terms from people at the CDC when they're talking to members of Congress or people in Washington. Simple terms like evidence-based or family planning or science-based, things that people in your position, Dr. Frieden, say all the time when they're describing the science that's part of their professions. What have you heard about that?
I haven't seen any information. I don't have any firsthand information about it. Certainly, it's not uncommon for people to think about what's going to be the most convincing way to argue for the very important programs that need to be supported. To me, there's really only one bottom line, and that's what the bottom line is. What is going to be the funding for CDC to protect Americans? There's a crucial issue here that with Ebola, there was a significant investment in strengthening systems to track and stop diseases overseas so we don't have to fight them here, so there wouldn't be another preventable epidemic like Ebola. That funding is evaporating, and if it's not replaced, Americans will be less safe.
Dr. Tom Frieden, President and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives, an initiative of Vital Strategies, former director of the Centers for Disease Control during the Obama administration. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to Europe now, where some big insurance companies have been making moves to separate from the coal industry. It's all over concerns about climate change. 15 insurers across Europe have cut or reduced their investments in companies tied to the coal industry to the tune of billions of dollars. And so the question now is whether this pressure on coal from the insurance industry will soon be felt in the United States. Oliver Ralph is insurance correspondent for the Financial Times in London. Hi, Oliver.
Hi.
So, Oliver, what exactly is going on between big insurance and big coal in Europe?
So there's a couple of things going on here in insurance. Some insurance companies have decided to stop offering insurance policies to some kinds of coal mining companies and also to power stations that use coal. They've decided they don't want to take these risks on anymore. The other thing that's happening is that as investors, insurers have a lot of money in the premiums they take in from their customers and they invest it. And they've decided that as investors, they're going to pull some or all of their money out of the coal industry and put it instead into clean energy.
Now, you said these big insurance companies don't want to take this kind of risk. Are these insurance companies stepping away because they see actuarial risk that they think is not profitable? Or is this political and marketing pressure that they don't want to be seen as doing business with big polluters?
I suspect it's a mixture of the two. Certainly the marketing perspective and the PR perspective doesn't do any harm. But they also think there's an actuarial risk. Global warming is not good for their businesses. Thomas Buberl, he's the chief executive of AXA, which is one of the insurers involved. He says that a world in which temperatures rise by 4 degrees is not insurable. And they're worried that if there is global warming, that leads to less predictable and more volatile weather, which ultimately is more expensive for insurance companies.
What does this pulling away mean for the coal companies? Does it mean that they can't build new coal-fired power plants? Does it mean that they can't mine if they don't have insurance coverage?
Well, they all need insurance coverage to do these activities. So far, the only four companies have taken action on refusing to provide cover. So it hasn't had a big impact on the market, according to people who operate within the market. But the pressure will tell. And if more insurance companies follow, then yes, it will be harder for coal companies to find insurance or more expensive. And I think this is what the pressure groups backing these changes want to see. They want to see life become harder for the companies that mine and use coal.
Well, the politics of global warming and climate change are a little different in Europe than they are here in the United States. That's for sure, Oliver. Any chance that this type of actuarial and political action from big insurance comes to the United States?
Well, it hasn't so far. There doesn't seem to be the same political pressure in the U.S. I guess given the politics coming from the White House, it's not perhaps the case that there's as much political pressure in the U.S. as there has been in Europe for insurance companies to take action. So I think that's much slower, and that obviously will limit the impact of whatever the industry is doing, because if a coal company can't find cover from a European insurer, probably there will be a U.S.-based insurer that's willing to offer it instead, or indeed one that's based somewhere else in the world.
What have the coal companies in Europe had to say about this?
Well, the trade body that speaks for the coal industry wouldn't talk to me at all. So they had nothing to say. I did speak to the insurance brokers who work with coal companies and buy insurance on their behalf. And the insurance brokers say that their clients are worried. They say that so far they've not seen any increase in the price of insurance. So at the moment they can still buy, but they're worried that this trend will spread to other insurers. It started with a few in Europe. And the concern is that if others take part, then it will bite. the companies that will be affected most really are small and medium-sized ones. The huge global mining companies, a lot of them have in-house insurance companies. Effectively, they self-insure a lot of these risks. So it's not so much the case that they're buying insurance elsewhere. Who it really will affect is the small and medium-sized companies, and particularly those in emerging markets where coal is still very widely mined and widely used.
Oliver Ralph, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Oliver Ralph covers insurance for the Financial Times in London. It's been just about a year since the Trump administration gave the go-ahead to complete the Dakota Access Pipeline. Crude oil started flowing through that pipeline on June 1st, and since then, Dakota Access has been mostly out of the headlines. Meanwhile, over the course of 2017, that pipeline leaked at least five times. These spills are relatively small. They range from a 20-gallon leak in North Dakota to 168 gallons in Illinois. Energy Transfer Partners, which is the company that developed the pipeline and owns it, says these leaks were all consolidated or isolated on their sites, small leaks. But critics say that the track record raises concerns about the company and how seriously it takes safety. Aline Brown is a reporter for The Intercept. She's been looking into Energy Transfer Partners. She joins me now here in the studio. Aline, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the entire basis of the protests at Standing Rock in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline was the risk that spills could cause to the environment and to drinking water. You found that spills have actually been happening, even if they're not big ones.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that opponents of the pipeline repeated was that it's not if the pipeline spills, it's when it spills. So now, you know, looking back at the record for 2017, we see that it is the case that the pipeline has spilled. You know, both state regulators and, as you said, industry have said that these are relatively minor spills, that they haven't entered waterways. In a few cases, the federal regulator says that the contamination did enter soil. But yeah, you know, the pipeline has spilled.
Now, is it true that these are relatively small spills that have been contained, that they're basically not an environmental threat because it's, you know, 20 gallons here and 17 gallons there?
You know, it's all a matter of degree, I would say. It's not to the level of, you know, we saw this massive spill this past November on TransCanada's Keystone Pipeline of 210,000 gallons of oil in a farm field in South Dakota. So I think that's the kind of thing that regulators are more concerned about. But again, I think it speaks to the nature of these projects and the fact that they are a little bit leaky.
You also looked at another energy transfer project, another pipeline in Ohio called Rover, slightly different. What about Rover?
So Rover has been under some heat. It's a natural gas pipeline, and that one had a big spill of drilling mud during construction. So that is this liquid that's made up of clay and water, and it's supposed to be non-toxic, but when you put 2 million gallons of it into a wetland, you know, it's a problem. And in this case, that liquid was contaminated with diesel, which is very unusual, according to regulators I've spoken to.
Well, you reached out to Energy Transfer Partners. They run Rover. They run Dakota Access and other pipelines, too. What did they say to you?
They told me that, well, for one, the first three spills on the Dakota Access Pipeline were all during this testing period. So they were before June 1st when the project was in service. And even the last spill, they say, was contained to this concrete area, a pumping station where they monitor the flow of oil. So they say that they were contained and minor.
Well, we reached out to Energy Transfer Partners as well. They said that they take safety seriously, both for their workers and for communities. They said that they deliver 99.96% of the liquid fossil fuel that they transport safely to its intended destination. But Aline, what's the bottom line here? The protesters at Standing Rock made a point that you made at the top, which is it's not a matter of if pipelines are going to spill, but a matter of when. Is that really the takeaway message here, that oil will get into the environment? It's really a question of how much.
Yeah, I mean, I would say one of my biggest takeaways is that, you know, we wouldn't be talking about this if it wasn't for the attention that organizers on the ground brought to the Dakota Access Pipeline. So it's really a matter of communities getting involved if we want to be aware of these kinds of realities.
Aline Brown, reporter for The Intercept, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org. Want to bring The Takeaway with you on the go? Subscribe to The Takeaway as a podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And for better or for worse, this is the most streamed song on Spotify. This is Ed Sheeran's Shape of You, streamed more than 1.5 billion times on Spotify. Well, at the end of December, the music streaming giant... Actually, guys, can we get rid of this? Can you put on something else, please, just so I can get through this? Short time, man. I've been on this life thing. I live like kings. In the middle, set aside all the nice things. Searching for a life. Thank you. That's better. Odyssey, Digging Deep from the Iceberg album, A DC Man. All right, let's get on with it. At the end of December, the music streaming giant Spotify filed for plans to go public on the New York Stock Exchange. It's pretty remarkable because only about 15 years ago, online music was the number one threat to the CD-based music industry. Well, this is not Napster anymore. No, it seems like corporate record labels have figured out how to make money once again in the digital age, and Spotify is a big part of the reason why. So the music streaming giant is taking its millions of paying customers and its ad revenue and your data and making moves to take it all public. Here to talk about what this all means for the business and for listeners is Mark Hogan, staff writer for Pitchfork.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Well, Mark, let's talk a little bit about the Wall Street aspect to this, because I definitely want to talk about the music that Spotify controls so effectively now. Spotify wants to go public. The question is, why now?
Sure. Well, there's been speculation about them going public, you know, for years now, and going public for them has become a little bit more urgent the last couple of years. They raised some money through debt, and the deal imposes really tough penalties, like basically the longer that they go without going public. So we've been kind of watching for when that would happen. And then just last week, they reportedly filed the paperwork. The filing is confidential, actually, but people are expecting Spotify shares to start hitting the markets by the end of March.
Well, let's talk about those shares for 1 second, because this Spotify listing is not the traditional IPO, the initial public offering that we're familiar with. It's a little bit of a different move to get onto the stock exchange. What's Spotify up to?
What this is it's called a direct listing. And, you know, normally, I mean, after a traditional IPO, there's usually a lockup period where company insiders can't sell any further stock. And if you do a direct listing, that restriction isn't in place. So, you know, that would be good for executives and other people who currently own shares, you know, privately in Spotify and want to sell them. Also, again, you know, they're not creating a bunch of new shares here. So a lot of times when a company goes public, it's to raise a bunch of equity capital through creating those new shares. Spotify apparently has raised enough capital, and what they really want is to be on the stock market. And that's, again, presumably because of the debt financing deal that they did in 2016.
All right, executives and shareholders, good for them. Mark, let's talk about music fans, because right now you can stream some music for free on Spotify if you're willing to listen to ads. That's part of the business model. You can pay that monthly premium charge to have no ads and to download a lot more music that they have available. Is that basic deal that Spotify offers listeners now likely to change?
I mean, that's all kind of reading the tea leaves and speculation. But the free tier isn't going anywhere, because there's been all these interviews with their chief marketing officer talking about how they really see themselves being behind like Google and Facebook for advertising, being one of the biggest advertisers in the world. And that would be on the free tier. And presumably that would be, you know, global, not just the States, but all around the world. They have a lot of room for growth with people who can't or won't or just aren't used to paying for music.
Well, you got to tell investors a good story every quarter. Look, listeners aren't just listeners to Spotify. They're data. So how does Spotify use people's personal information and data now? And if they go public, are there going to be incentives to use that data more and in potentially more intrusive ways?
Sure. I mean, it's going to be really interesting to watch, because Spotify has a ton of data, and that's part of what powers, part of what makes them so powerful is their data. I mean, they can tell what everybody's listening to, and they can see how deep into the song you listen, what other music you like. So they can tell when a hit is picking up in some part of the world and try to figure out who else might like it. So they've got all that data and they've been using that with their playlists and just internally. And I definitely, you would think that there'd be a temptation at least to use that in other ways. I mean, they could potentially sell the data to some of the big live music companies. Definitely, I think Spotify is just going to be maybe more things to more different people.
So look, being offered on the public markets means that Spotify is going to be looking for a lot of new revenue streams here, Mark. Would they want to be a label themselves? They deal with a lot of big record labels now. But look, Netflix, Amazon, in the video world, they've started producing a lot of their own content, and a lot of it's great. Would Spotify want to get into this in the music business?
That's the fascinating thing to watch. I mean, it would make sense to do that, right? With Spotify, I mean, a huge portion of their costs is paying all these licensing fees for the music that they haven't created. And if they were to act more like a label and get commission their own music and get it created themselves, you would think that that could potentially solve that. Everybody's been kind of wondering about that for a while. There were reports last year about this company in Sweden that they had kind of worked with to put a bunch of music on some of the like ambient and chill out and sleep type playlists. And there's kind of a lot of conflicting claims there, but they haven't ever quite put together, Spotify, the label. Last year, they also acquired an online recording studio, so that could be a step toward it. They launched a program where they promote what they called, kind of the future breaking stars. And I believe the people on those lists were mostly folks that were already found by the major labels. But, maybe they could start trying to do that and cultivate some of their own artists. That remains to be seen, but it would make a lot of sense, except for the fact that it could potentially alienate the major labels that they have to do deals with. And we'll see how that also affects the relationship with listeners who want to look to Spotify as, objective and not necessarily steering them toward just whatever is most lucrative for Spotify.
Mark Hogan from Pitchfork, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Todd.
You can find Mark Hogan's reporting for Pitchfork, What Spotify Going Public Could Mean for Music Fans. It's at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's great to have you with us today. I'm Todd Zwillich. If you have young kids in your life, here's a scenario that you're probably familiar with. A child is melting down a little bit in a restaurant, so mom or dad puts an iPhone in their hand, a little video pacifier just to calm them down for a little while. Did mom or dad just give an addictive dose of screen time to an impressionable brain? Flash forward to that child at 7 or 9 years old when they retreat behind a screen or a game whenever they feel stressed. There's a lot of research saying parents should limit kids' screen time, but it's not always easy to do.
There's actually really interesting research. Half of American parents are saying that regulating their child's screen time is a constant battle. I would put myself in that category as well.
That's Manoj Zomorodi, host of Note to Self from WNYC Studios and author of the book Bored and Brilliant. We asked Manoj to join us after news earlier this week that several Apple investors were calling on the company to do more to limit addiction to iPhones. And they cited research that shows the negative impact of screen time on those developing young brains. So what exactly do these investors really want here? I asked Manoj.
Well, that's what's so interesting about this is that it's actually kind of nebulous. What they want Apple to do is curb growing smartphone addiction among children. I mean, first of all, the term smartphone addiction is being hotly debated. The question is also like, how do you curb it? But what I also think is super interesting is that they're saying not only is it going to be good for our children if Apple gives parents more ways to help their kids manage their time on Apple devices, they're saying that this is going to be good for the company. And I have to say, I have spent the last 6 months traveling around the country talking to a lot of parents as part of my book tour with Bored and Brilliant. And it's specifically about how we regulate our time on devices. And I think that they're right. I think that it will be good for the bottom line. There is a sense that this idea of rethinking how we use our devices is going mainstream. Now, the question is, what does that mean? Does that mean more things in your settings app that you have to figure out? Because that's kind of a nightmare. Or is it more sort of commissioning research into actually understanding, is there a causal effect of time spent looking at an iPhone or another smartphone on children's brains, on their behavior, etc.?
Well, that's interesting because this news was counterintuitive at first. You saw the headline, investors want limits on phone addiction, and you would think, well, why would investors want that? More phone use at a young age means more phone use when you're older. That's good for the bottom line. You're suggesting that parents are saying, no, 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 this is a business opportunity for you to give us tools so that we can limit phone time for our kids.
Absolutely. This is something that families are dealing with on a daily basis. How much time is the right time? Does it matter what they're looking at? Well, if he's spending 6 hours on Minecraft, which is supposed to be good, is that better than 1 hour playing some kind of mindless game? Like, there's lots of questions about not just screen time, but content, and more broadly, sort of this idea of how do we, if the companies aren't going to do it, how do we help our kids regulate themselves?
So there are a lot of impressions among parents about how much screen time is appropriate, how much time you want your kid to be spending behind the Switch or the Game Boy or what have you, or the iPhone. Yeah. What does the research say? What do we know about screen time and young kids? Are there any definitive data about how much is too much, or even how old a kid should be before they look at a screen?
Yeah, so the American Pediatric Association changed their rules, I believe it was last year, saying that there should be, they used to say no TV for kids 2 and under, and then they changed it to no screen time 2 and under, which makes sense, because I, for one, have seen, and maybe even done it myself, standing in line at the grocery store, and your toddler is screaming, and you just got to get out of there, so you hand them the phone, right? Like, we do these things, but it's good to start to have sort of regulation around it. And there's also starting to be more research. We know that the levels of depression and anxiety in our young people is growing extremely rapidly. There's research showing that eighth graders who are heavy users of social media have a 27% higher risk of depression. We're also seeing a lot of increasing rates of ADD in college students. There's been some suggestion that maybe this is related to time spent online. It's very difficult to prove simply because these devices are still pretty new. The smartphone's only 10 years old. It's very difficult to prove, like, oh, this person is depressed because they spent X number of hours on social media. And I think that's where I'm starting to see there needs to be a broader discussion, not only about screens and controls and parental controls, but about mental health and understanding what the warning signs are for teenagers being able to say, like, this isn't making me feel good, I'm feeling anxious about this, and changing cultural norms to say, like, I'm going to put it away. I had a little interaction with my 13-year-old neighbor the other day, Todd, and she just got her first phone. And I said, oh, I was trying to be cool. I was like, oh, are you going to be on Instagram this weekend? And she looked at me. She was like, only losers are on their phones all weekend.
Oh.
And I was like, that's so interesting. Like, maybe there is a shift that's happening, you know, that there's going to be it. Maybe it's us, like Gen Xer and millennial parents, who are actually having the issues. And this next generation is going to say, we've seen you turn into a zombie at the dinner table with your phone, mom and dad. We don't want to be like this.
That's
and
interesting.
I think so. That's my prediction.
You think that might be a reaction of young kids who've seen their parents behind their phones all day and say, no, that's not the way to be at all.
I do. And I think that if Apple is smart, that's the next generation of consumers. And not only Apple, like, let's talk about Android and Amazon and all the other companies that are really changing the very fabric of our society right now, and how families discipline, how they love, how they connect, how they keep in touch. All of these things, they're having an incredible effect on every single part of our society. And so if they want to continue to provide us, the consumers, with tools instead of making us feel like they're dictating our lives, they need to be sensitive to this new demand that I think is going to, it's just starting.
And so back on the young kids for just a moment, Manoush, investors say, hey, Apple, there's a business opportunity to build in limits for screen time for kids. Are they going to convince Apple that that's true?
Look, Apple is, of all of the companies, they're usually the most conservative and slow, but they also are very attuned to what their customers want. I think we've seen other companies, for example, last year, Google introduced something called Family Link as a way that parents can limit the apps that their kids have access to. Amazon has something built in that sets daily goals and time limits. But I think it's a, yes, you can add features and functions. That's all wonderful. But the question is, will Apple see this as a wake-up call to be a leader in a more sort of sociological way about where the technology fits into kids' lives? And I think that's a huge opportunity for the company. And, you know, they're the ones who actually are doing the best when it comes to privacy, data privacy. Maybe this is where they'll go next. It'll be very interesting to watch.
Manoj Zomorodi, author of Bored and Brilliant and host of the fantastic podcast from WNYC, Note to Self. Manoj, a pleasure.
It was really fun. Thanks, Todd.
Well, a lot of you have been talking to us. How have you tried to regulate your kids' screen time?
This is Laura in Austin, Texas. So my kids, no devices at dinner. And then two times a day for 15-minute slots, 10 to 15-minute slots. Beyond that, they violate the rules. They're punished by relentless nagging.
Tell us about your battle against the screen, including the weapon of relentless nagging. Call us 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.